Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, and welcome to Drinking Well, a podcast by Barry Brothers and Rudd, with me, Barbara Drew. Today, I'm sitting down with Rob Symington, fifth generation of Symington Family Estates, to discuss fortified wines, the future of the port industry, and the evolution of a fellow family business. Rob, welcome.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure. So before we get stuck into the wonders and the delights of fortified wine, can you give us a very brief background as to who you are and where you fit into the family tree?
Born and bred in Portugal, but I don't sound particularly Portuguese.
You
because
do not.
We are part of the long, long tradition of British families in the port trade. Shipped off to boarding school age 8, and then finally found my way home to work in the family business 7 years ago. Overlapped with my dad for 2 years before he retired, which was just long enough. And I am one of the leaders of our commercial team.
And what does that involve? What's your day-to-day job? Are you out in the vineyards? Are you traveling around the world, persuading people that port is the only drink that they should be buying? What does the commercial side involve?
I think any fine wine producer has two fundamental things. The wine itself has to be incredible, and then you have to do an excellent job in a very competitive world of wine, in getting out there, telling the story and selling. And I'm not a winemaker, although I've done my share of harvests, but my responsibility is to ensure that our sales and marketing teams in the 85 markets that we sell to with multiple brands are doing a fantastic job of engaging people, building real relationships with the trade and the end consumer, because port invariably, once people taste it, even if they thought it wasn't for them, often we convert them as soon as they get it on their lips. Our job is to be out there flying the flag, and that's what we do.
Well, forgive me, that sounds very modern. There is definitely a preconception, I think, still within the industry that port is a very sort of traditional style of wine. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Do you know what? I had the same preconception. So my career trajectory, not to do my CV point by point, but I started at Ernst & Young in consulting. I wasn't massively inspired by the big corporate world, and I built a business called Escape the City, which helps people make dramatic and unconventional career changes. And I tell you that in the context of port, because when I got to the end of a 10-year campaign from my old man, bless him, to say, come back to Porto, help run the family business, it's all going to fail unless you turn up. And then when I did turn up, he didn't have the foggiest idea what to do with me, of course. My big apprehension was, is this going to be like stepping back in time, a little bit like the incredible Berry Brothers and Rudd offices, where nothing has changed because port is traditional and all the rest of it. And when I had my first meetings with my now colleagues, I realized that, yes, there's a lot of what we do, which is very traditional, and my grandfather and great-grandfather would recognize it. But I also realized that this was an organization that had reinvented itself, certainly every generation, but almost every decade. And that is the only way you stay relevant. So port today, from a distance, can seem like a very classic category of wine. And I found that very motivating because I had permission and, in fact, the encouragement to come in, not me by myself, but there's a whole generation of us, figuring out what's good about what we have and figuring out how to evolve it to make it relevant to the 21st century.
That's really exciting. Before we sort of go into the future of port and where it's heading and the port industry, let's set the scene a little bit for our listeners. Yeah. It would be great if you could give us a little bit of an overview as to how the port industry works, because there are lots of shippers and some of them grouped together and some of them are independent. And how does that all work?
If I started the Douro Valley, which is where the wine is from, the Douro, for any of your listeners who don't know what it looks like or haven't been there, is a stunning DOC, a regulated wine region. Port can only come from that region. More than half of the world's mountain vineyard is in our valley.
No, wow, what does that mean?
It means that vineyards on slopes of more than 30 degrees incline. We have 53% of all mountain vineyard in the world. This is extreme viticulture. No other region even has about 5%. So honestly, you'd look at our terraces and you'd think people must be desperate to have a drink in order to have carved these things back in the day, pre-mechanization, out of very steep cliffs. As a result, it's a stunning region. In 2003, it was awarded UNESCO World Heritage status, and they called it a human landscape, i.e. the interplay between the human influence on the natural topography. So it's stunning. And I tell you that because we're very proud of our region, and that's where the port comes from. The historical quirk here around the shippers, and you used the word shippers, is interesting because my great-great-grandfather was not a producer in the classic sense that we would know it today. He was buying wine and trading it. So that's why all the port companies are based in Porto, mm-hmm. not up inland, because they were shipping from the port. Porto literally means port. And that's also why many of the names that you'll see on the famous port houses, Sanderman, Graham, Coburn, are either English or Scottish. There are also a lot of Portuguese houses and some Dutch ones, because these were entrepreneurs who were trading. And that's where we came from. Now, over the last generation and a half, probably two generations, we have all become growers and producers as well, with ridiculous amounts of our own steep vineyards to cultivate and plant and all the rest of it. Port trade has gone through a certain amount of consolidation in recent years, certainly since my father's generation started in the late 70s. So Symington Family Estates has this incredible stable of well-known port brands. Dow's, Waugh's, Graham's and Coburn's are our foremost well-known ones. So we are an independent family business, but we own and run four historic port houses, which were originally independent themselves.
How do you get on with the other members of the port industry? I mean, it's fair to say it's not a huge sea that you're all working in. Are you best friends with the other houses? Is there friendly rivalry? How does that work?
There is friendly rivalry, but honestly, it's a small world. Porto is a small town and the Douro is a small wine producing region. Frankly, we're all in the same boat. We are all committed to flying the flag for Portuguese wine and port and the Douro as a region outside. So there are actually not that many British families left. Out of the big five port companies, two are British owned, one is Portuguese, one is owned by a Spanish bank and one is owned by a French multinational. So it's not the sort of stereotypical old school Thai Brits in Porto sitting around a large lunch table until the evening. And so our big rivals are Taylor Fladgate, who have Taylor's Port and Croft and Fonseca. We do compete in all the markets and we like to tease each other. And we each have our strategies, which actually are surprisingly quite different. Lizzie Rudd, your chair, came to visit us in May 2022. And then immediately afterwards went and had a tour around WOW, which is the amazing new development,
World of Wine,
rebranded just WOW, because there's more than just wine going on there. And she met Adrian Bridge, who's the CEO of Taylor Fladgate. And she said, wow, you guys could not be more different, which I found amusing because from the outside, people just expect us to all be cut from the same cloth. But we get on very well. We are regularly talking about aspects of joint promotion and what we can do to fly the flag for port. And a little bit of friendly rivalry with a smile on our faces is part of it.
You mentioned no lunches, which saddens me. Is there no blind tasting on a Wednesday afternoon when the post doesn't come in?
Well, there absolutely is. And one of the reasons we have to get on is there's this incredible institution in downtown Porto called the Factory House. And the Factory House has this legendary Wednesday lunch, which, as you say, Barbara, was the slow day where no post had arrived from overseas. So once people had done one or two tasks in the morning, they'd go over to this incredible club funded by the port houses, so everyone would pay their dues. And these legendary Wednesday lunches, which we still do, but we now do them in about 2 hours, not five. And we bring trade and we bring sommeliers and journalists and customers. And we keep it going because it's an incredible tradition.
Fantastic. Still waiting for my invite there.
Well, we can do it now. I'll give you a live invite. We need all the fresh blood we can get at the Factory House. Enthusiastic MWs are always welcome. I'll see you next year.
So tell me about some of the initiatives that are underway at the moment in the Valley to revitalise port and Portuguese wine, to promote port, to get new consumers in. What's happening in the 21st century there?
There's a huge amount happening. That we face big challenges, whether they be environmental or social. The Douro is a monoculture where most people live from the sale of grapes. And there's a whole grower culture, like in Champagne, where we farm 1,000 hectares of our own vineyard, but we also buy from 800 growers. So we are embedded in the fabric of the region. It's a region in flux. It's in flux for lots of reasons, because in the past, it was essentially all the grapes were turned into port to be sold in Portugal and in markets around the world. Today, it's almost 50-50 port and dry wines, still wines from the Douro, 50-50 split. And in the last 10 years, tourism, not only to Porto and Lisbon, which is, I think, on everyone's radar, everyone's list, but actually the more intrepid wine tourists coming up the valley to spend 1, 2, or 3 nights exploring the quintas, the estates, and tasting and going out on the river and going for walks. When I was growing up there in the late 80s and early 90s, we would see a backpacker or a tourist and we would literally point and go, look, a tourist, because it was so rare. And now our region has three bases of its economy, which is, yes, port. The still wines of the Douro are incredibly high quality. And there's a new generation of winemakers, probably since the turn of the century onwards, but in the last 15 years, doing really exciting things. And the quality is consistently improving. And today we're really competing on the world stage with those still wines. And the amount of restaurants and hotels and other experiences in the Douro Valley. So our future as a company is built around those three pillars, whereas my grandfather wouldn't have recognized two of them. He would say, we're a port house. He would have used the word shipper. So back to my point about change and how motivating it is to have the privilege of coming into a family business and be told, right, you guys have got to figure out what's next. It's very exciting.
So tourism is a stated aim of the Symington Family Estates now.
Absolutely. We now run 3 visitor centers and 3 restaurants.
Wow.
We are currently building a clubhouse for wine lovers in downtown Porto. And I hope, if the cost of construction doesn't get completely crazy and out of reach, within a couple of years, we will start building an amazing boutique hotel at the Dows, at the leading Dows estate in the heart of the region. So it's a big bet of ours. And the sales growth and the visitor numbers over the last 8 to 10 years give us confidence that this is a strategy that makes sense.
I suppose it does make sense. The wine industry has always been about hospitality. Here at Berry Brothers and Rudd, it's not simply about coming into the shop and getting that perfect bottle of wine, although that's part of the experience, but it's coming to the cellars, it's tasting the wine, having it with food, sharing those experiences with other wine lovers. And even better if you can do that in a beautiful region, gorgeous weather, at least when you get inland, beautiful vineyards. For me, it's really part and parcel of the wine experience. It's not just the bottle, it's everything. So it makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. And you're right to say hospitality and experience, because port is a wine that has togetherness in its DNA, whether it's decanting it and passing it to the left and that moment at the end of the meal, whether you're guessing the vintage or...
Terrible game, honestly. Blind tasting should be outlawed.
Well, even if it's an MW like yourself, this should be catnip for you.
Done enough blind tasting for a lifetime.
Well, when you work for a wine family, people expect you to be able to spot any wine at 1,000 paces and are constantly trying to catch you out. So, no, but you're absolutely right. Wine tourism, or enotourism, as it's more pretentiously known, frankly, is a fantastic form of sales and marketing. Mm. It's the best way, because people are coming to us, to our lodges in Porto, up to the vineyards, and they're paying us for the privilege of us showing our wines to them. And invariably, those people will become better educated about port, more loyal towards our brands when they go home, and they'll try and find our wines where they live. And actually, if I go back to what we do commercially, yes, we're selling and marketing, but the best relationships, and the word is relationships, are always built around that authenticity of connection. Yeah. We're often selling to importers. We've been selling to them for 40 years. And that's, I think, why the people love the wine trade, love working in the wine trade so much, because it's overwhelmingly decent people who enjoy the finer things in life, but enjoy togetherness and having a laugh. And so wine tourism allows us to broaden what used to be very much a sort of trade hospitality thing. Come and stay at our estate, dear Berry Brothers buyer or Jancis Robinson, whoever it is. And now we can do that at scale. We have 100,000 people visiting us a year. And actually, we're trying to keep our visitor numbers down because we want to focus on the quality of the experience and not the quantity. We're not interested in a sort of Disney-fied visitor experience.
We will get onto the wines very shortly, don't worry. But just on that theme of tourism, you talked about the river. Obviously, in the past, there have been boats that will go all the way up the river. Tell me a little bit about that, because obviously, without the river, tourism is problematic, shall we say.
Yeah, well, the river is now dammed, which has massively changed the environment. In my dad's age, well, when dad was a kid, he remembers scorpions in little rock pools and this gorge down at the bottom. And back then, whole families would crew boats taking barrels from the Douro region downriver to the Atlantic coast where they'd be shipped to markets around the world, often shipped in barrel and then bottled by brewers in the UK and stuff like that. So today it's more like a series of lakes. So we've got these dams, which are a big part of Portugal's renewable energy system. There's a whole ecosystem of small boats taking people on tours up and down the valley. Most people arrive in the region either by car or there's this fantastic railway line that goes from Porto to the Douro, and most of it goes along the river. So it's a beautiful and very romantic way to arrive.
Slightly less winding than the roads as well, which I recall have some quite nauseating bends in them.
Exactly, especially after a couple of glasses of port. So you can drink port without any sense of irresponsibility in the train, have a kip, and when you wake up, you're arriving in the region, in the valley.
The wines, you said that still wine is now, you know, when we say still wine, we sort of mean table wine, anything that's not been fortified, is now about 50% of production. Is it the local port grapes that are used? Is it other grapes? Are we seeing Cabernet Sauvignon? Tell me about this still wine boom.
So there's a quota, just like in Champagne and other fine wine regions of the world, there's a certain amount of grapes that can be turned into port. And it's to do with maintaining quality and other things to protect the sanctity of the category. In the past, everything that didn't have the designation of port grapes was called by the locals consumo, which literally means that's for consuming, i.e. locally. And by us, and not commercialized at all. So, you know, everyone would have their wine, which they'd made with their percentage of their grapes that they weren't permitted by the government to turn into port. And then some pioneers in the mid to late 20th century decided, what are we doing? We've got incredible raw material here. And actually, the grapes that make excellent still wines, and we're using that phrase, as you said, just to contrast against the fortified wines that are port, often it's different locations. It's higher up the valley, it's north-facing slopes. So for a rich, structured, sweet fortified wine like port, you want lower-lying, south-facing vineyards. In terms of varieties, there is remarkably few what you'd call international or French grape varieties in Portugal as a whole and in the Douro. We have an incredibly rich diversity of indigenous grape varieties. Sometimes this can work against us. A lot of people have never heard of them.
True.
But they are extremely well adapted to our terroir, and as a result, make wines that are very authentically Portuguese. And increasingly, people who are interested in Portugal and Portuguese wines are understanding what these varieties are, whether it's the famous Touriga Nacional. Touriga Nacional is a strong component of the best still wines of the Douro, but it's also the backbone of the great vintage ports.
Yep.
So this is a versatile grape variety that new generation of winemakers that I was referencing are learning how to use and how to vinify in order to make it a stunning reds with amazing structure and longevity and aging potential.
And does this mean that there's more Touriga Nacional being planted in the vineyards? Because it's still a relatively small proportion of plantings, despite the fact that it's the grape that everyone shouts about. It goes into the vintage ports, it goes into the still wines. Yeah. And you think, where's it all coming from? Because there's an awful lot of other grapes planted there as well.
Yeah, fantastic question. And Touriga Nacional has a really interesting story over the last 100 years. If I remind you about the grower nature of the Douro, you have roughly 20,000 farmers. 95% of them are what you would call semi-professional growers or people with fewer than 1.5 hectares. So these are people who selling the grapes to a producer like us is part of their income, but not the entirety of it because of the scale of their plots. It makes for an incredibly rich community of growers. But if you are a farmer and you have to figure out what to plant, you are going to plant the highest yielding varieties because you get paid invariably on weight.
Yeah.
The Touriga Nacional, small berries, not the highest yielding grape variety, but incredible quality. And so historically, it fell out of favor because of the yield issue. And there's a really interesting story that actually is relevant to Cobens Port. So Cobens, in 1969, at the time, weren't owned by our family. Some pioneering viticulturalists at Cobens did a lot of research into different grape varieties and their potential for producing excellent port. Now, at the time in the UK, ruby port in pubs and vintage port served at state dinners. There wasn't much in between. And the innovation of Cobens was special reserve. And the idea here was a high quality port that was accessible to normal people. And the secret of special reserve, which is a reserve port, so i.e. one rung up the quality ladder from normal ruby port, aged between 4 to 6 years in large oak casks. The secret was Touriga Nacional. Huh. And Cobens had a nursery in the Douro Superior, up near the Spanish border.
A vine nursery, we should clarify.
A vine nursery, not children. Yeah, child labor in the Douro thankfully fell out of fashion a long time ago. We're completely above board now. What's really interesting is that Cobens, a vineyard nursery, was essentially the seedbed, or correct me if I've used the wrong terminology there, for most of the Touriga Nacional that has now been planted everywhere around the region. And because what happened was the boom in special reserve sales, massively off the back of the UK market, allowed shippers, producers to pay a premium for Touriga Nacional grapes and therefore motivate the growers and incentivize them to plant more Touriga Nacional. So we now, I'd say 25% of our own vineyards are Touriga Nacional, not because we're chasing quantity in the vineyard, but because we know that the quality is there.
That's so interesting. I mean, as is so often the case, you can spend as much as you like in the winery, all of these new innovations, but if you don't go back to the vineyards and really look at quality there, whether it's the quality of the location, whether it's the quality of the vine materials and the plantings, you're never going to end up with a great product further down the line. And what about still white wines from the Douro Valley? I'm afraid I still say Douro. I'm listening to your pronunciation here, and I'm thinking about how it's spelled and I just can't quite match up the two in my head.
The Portuguese accent is famously hard to get one's head around.
Are there many still white wines being produced, or is this really a predominantly red grape and red wine region?
We are a red grape and red wine region. Port is 90% red, although there is a very interesting category called white port, which has aged variants, but also young white ports, which is having a little bit of a moment at the moment. If you've never had a white port and tonic, which you make exactly like a gin and tonic, I would strongly recommend it. A very refreshing summer drink. So roughly 10% of the vineyards in the Douro are white grapes, usually at the higher altitudes where you get cooler temperatures and more rainfall. And this new wave of still wines from the Douro has got a strong white component. White wines globally are, I think, growing, or at least they're performing better at a global basis than red wines. And in Portugal, which is the primary market for wines from the Douro, as you would expect, white wines are booming. And my father has his own vineyard up at 550 meters. We're all mad for vineyards in our family. And so whenever anyone has any spare money, they go and buy more vineyard, which, you know, sounds completely mad and the opposite of a diversification strategy. But what he does is he sells his own grapes to our company and is constantly complaining about the price he gets. But because he's at altitude and our winemakers, and we've got a strategy to develop our white wine portfolio from the Douro, we're constantly saying to him, you've got to plant white up there because you've got the perfect position and exposition and altitude. So it will always be part of our mix. I don't think white wines from the Douro will suddenly become the main thing, but it's a really interesting part of what the Douro produces, and the wines speak for themselves.
Now, I can see you eyeing up the bottle that you've brought with us, and with good reason, quite frankly. You have really treated us here. So do you want to tell us a little bit about the port, so fortified, and we'll get that opened up and we can get stuck in?
With pleasure. So I don't know if we should tell your listeners that it's about 9:45 in the morning, but you know, in the service of a decent podcast, I think it's only right that we share a glass of Graham's 40-year-old aged tawny. So I recently turned 40 a couple of months ago. So I was either going to bring a bottle of 1983 vintage port, which is my birth year. And then I thought, you know what? Let's bring an aged tawny, which is a blended wine. So it's not exactly 40 years old. It's an average of 40 years. And so that's how the Port Wine Institute regulates this category. Typically, we tend towards our aged tawnies, like the 40-year-old, having probably an average age of slightly higher than 40 years old, but let's not quibble on details. So this is a blended wine aged in small oak casks, 550 litres, seasoned oak, so not new French oak, but seasoned oak. We want...
And seasoned means, again, for listeners who might be thinking there's salt and pepper added into the oak barrel, it just means it's been aged and then toasted and then had...
It basically means it's as old as possible without it falling apart, because we want the characteristics that you get from old oak, not the young toasted barrels that are used for young red wines. We have the last in-house team of coopers in the port trade because we have tens of thousands of barrels. And on an annual, well, on a daily basis, this team of eight coopers, and it really is an art, and we have apprentices coming through and learning the craft. They are stripping barrels down and building them back together, replacing wonky staves and all the rest of it. Because a lot of people think that port is red port because that's the most well-known category. We've actually got these three amazing styles. We've got ruby, tawny, and white. Ruby and tawny are both made from red grapes. And basically the difference is tawnies are aged in small barrels and rubies are either aged in bottle or large barrels. So the small barrels give you a lot of contact with the oak and you get micro-oxygenation through the wood. And this is a form of alchemy that only time can achieve. Everyone knows about the angel's share from whiskey, but we have our own angel's share, which our finance team hate because we're literally, money is evaporating through the wood. So to give you an idea, when you have a 10-year-old tawny port, it's lost 20% of the volume of that liquid in the first 10 years. Once you get to a 40-year-old, you've lost half of the volume of the wine. And what remains is something like 53%. What remains is an incredibly complex and concentrated wine, not just with high levels of sweetness, which you'd expect, but also high levels of acidity. And that's what makes these aged tawny ports so enjoyable to drink, because they are actually quite refreshing. They're not cloying, they're not overly sweet, and it's that acidity. The tannic structure has kind of melted away, but it leaves an echo of complexity in those layers. And we, I don't know if this would be considered blasphemy by my grandfather, but we serve our tawny ports lightly chilled, because it just cuts slightly across the alcohol. It's only 20%, so it's not a particularly strong drink, but compared to a still wine, yeah, of course it, yeah, is.
Well, it certainly whet my appetite. I was sort of waiting for you to stop talking so that I could open it, actually.
You can edit out the waffle later. An important detail for your listeners is that people think, you know, vintage ports are aging wines. You put them in the cellar and they will keep getting better and evolving in bottle. You will notice that this tawny port has been bottled with a T-top, which is not a driven cork. You don't need a corkscrew. It's like a bottle of whiskey, and you can lift it off. And that's because the aging happens in the bottle. We've done all the work for you. These wines have been bottled ready to drink. Now, keep it in good conditions for a few years by all means, for the right moment to drink it. But these are not wines that will benefit from additional bottle aging. And in due course, they will fall away, because a T-top cork is not the same as a driven cork. So don't hang around, find the right moment and drink your tawny ports.
Does that say Nez Oublier?
Yeah, exactly. That is the original Graham family motto from Scottish Grahams from way back when. I'll tell you another, there are a couple of fun stories about Grahams. And actually, we've got to get on to the amusing stories around the shared history between my family business and the one that you...
Well, indeed, yes.
But I'll tell you the Graham one, shall I? Because it's quite a nice story at the beginning of tasting this 40-year-old. My great-great-grandfather, called AJ, Andrew James Symington, age 19, decided to leave Glasgow. And he had a letter of introduction, 19 years old, I'm going to go to Porto to seek my fortune. And the letter of introduction was from his father to a Mr. Graham. So he rocks up in Porto in 1882. And the letter of introduction... He goes and bangs on Mr. Graham's door and he says, can I have a job? And he gets given his first job as a clerk or as a something in the operation at Graham's. And that was his start in the port trade. In 1970, his grandchildren were given the opportunity to acquire Graham's port from the grandchildren of the family, the chap who had given him his first opportunity in port, which is an amazing sort of circular story. And we've had the privilege to take this prestigious house from strength to strength since 1970 until where we are today.
There's two things that strike me smelling this. First of all, Pajak, that smells delicious. But secondly, is the long-term thinking needed to produce something like this. This is a liquid that, as you say, is on average 40 years old, a little bit older. To be laying down that liquid in barrels so that it can turn into a 40-year-old port, you need a huge amount of foresight for that. And as you say, you need to make sure that the finance team are aware of what they're getting themselves into as it gradually evaporates, and to not pull it out of the barrel 10 years in and say, let's just sell it as a 10-year-old, but to keep going. That's really remarkable. Something arguably that is somewhat easier with a family business, perhaps.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Family businesses do think on different timescales to conventional or, you know, public traded companies or businesses that aren't owned by families. And then wine family businesses even more, because wine, by definition, requires insane amounts of patience and capital tied up in stocks and vineyards and wineries and all the rest of it. The lovely thing about these aged styles of tawny is these are the survivors, because on an annual basis, every barrel is getting tasted by our master blenders. And essentially, they will leave the best lots. We're not going to blend that into a 10-year-old, as you just said, because we think this has got legs to keep improving. So by the time you get to the 40-year-old, you really are talking about a small number of barrels. They're the survivors. They're the Olympic gold medal winners. And I'll give you a teaser, you and your listeners. The Port Wine Institute has just created a new category, which is the 50-year-old. And so in early 2024, we will be releasing the Graham's 50-year-old aged tawny.
Which you can only do, again, by sort of thinking ahead and saying, actually, we'll keep this stuff for a bit longer.
Exactly.
And those producers who hear that news and decide to start making a 50-year-old now have got a long path ahead of them.
That's right.
Well, this is absolutely incredible, this 40-year-old tawny. Of course, there's dried fruit character on the nose. There's a wonderful sort of marmalade-y note, but there's also something quite savoury, toasted nuts, even something a little bit marmite-y on this wine. Certainly, it's sweet. Ports are sweet. They're fortified during the fermentation, which means there's lots of unfermented grape sugar. And that's crucial. It is sugar from the grape itself. It's not been added in any way. It's natural sugar, so beautifully integrated there. But that acidity, it's very tangy. And this finish, just layers and layers of flavour that evolve minutes after you've tasted it. It's astonishing stuff. It really is.
You should come and work for us. That was an amazing elegy to the 40-year-old. But you're absolutely right. The purity and the length and the different notes. I often get tobacco and leather and chocolate as well when I'm tasting the old age tawnies. And very, very easy to drink. This is a completely mad comparison, but when you drink an excellent glass of champagne and people get that pep of energy, which I think comes from the acidity, I notice time and again when I serve tawny port at the end of a meal, people might be feeling a bit lethargic, they've eaten and drunk a lot, and then the tawny port comes around. You don't need to drink more than a sip or two of it. And the energy rises because suddenly people get a little arise from it because it's so enjoyable to drink.
And there's sort of so much flavour here, so much intensity. It really does wake up your palate just enough to get your brain going again. Quite remarkable. Why aren't wines like this more widely drunk and appreciated around the world? Apart from the fact that there's not that much produced because you have to lay the wine down for so very long and you lose so much. Are there other reasons why people don't enjoy aged tawny ports as much as they should?
Realistically, even myself, and I work for a port producer, I'm not drinking port on a daily basis, thank God, because I want to live a long and happy life and I wouldn't recommend it. So these are occasional wines. We have to be realistic. In the UK, port and Christmas are massively associated together, which is one of our biggest markets, the UK. We sell half of all our bottles in the last 8 to 10 weeks of the year. Coben Special Reserve sells a bottle every 11 seconds of October, November and December, day and night. Wow. There is a perception that fortified wines and particularly port, well, they are a niche category. We have to be realistic. But they have a very treasured and much loved place in people's hearts, particularly around family tables or around special times of the year, particularly Christmas. So why are they not more enjoyed and better known? We're working hard on it. Tourism is helping us unbelievably. The aged tawny styles, and by that I mean a reserve tawny up to now a 50-year-old. So you have the 10, the 20, the 30, the 40, and now the 50, as well as Kuliatage or single harvest tawnies, which is wines from a particular year. We recently launched a single harvest tawny from 1974, which was the year of the Portuguese Revolution. The 1950 came out recently. This category as a whole, aged tawny, is growing on average 20% year on year and has been for the last 10 years.
Does sound positive until you realise it's growing from a very small base.
It's quite a small base, although 10-year-old is hundreds of thousands of bottles a year around the world and available in a lot of decent supermarkets. We are a niche category. We have amazing staying power. So the UK has sold roughly 10 million bottles of port a year for the last 15 years. There's a bit of variation, but it's remarkably stable.
So rumours of its demise might be greatly exaggerated.
Obviously, it's an important narrative for me to show the other side to. The port category has two big sides. It has the standard qualities, which actually I shouldn't call them standard, but the classics, which is ruby tawny white, and it has the special categories, which is the reserve and upwards. And we essentially have a story of two parts. There has been a certain amount of stagnation and maybe a bit of fall off in volumes of the standard categories, but premium is growing. And actually, premiumization is a trend that you see in lots of categories around the world, not just wine. People want to drink less, and when they do drink, they want to drink a bit better. Frankly, for a port producer, that's actually music to our ears. What's interesting is the three largest port markets in the world are actually Belgium, France, and Netherlands. It's not the UK. The UK is the largest premium market. So the Brits are very loyal to port, and we thank you for it. In Belgium and France, actually, port is drunk as an aperitif, a petit apéro. There we are having a demographic falling away. It's not disastrous, but you know, 1% year on year for 20 years. Frankly, we don't have the marketing budgets of spirits and big multinationals. And there is only so much you can do when lifestyle changes. But we're a region in evolution and we're a category in evolution. So the Doru is going to be built around premium port, still wines and tourism. Whereas in the past, it was built around ruby port and some vintage as the cherry on the cake. And everything we're doing from packaging to marketing and the way we tell our stories and the experiences we create tries to have its eyes open to that reality, that we will be an occasional indulgence by people who appreciate what's special about port and the Doru.
An occasional indulgence. Well, it might be a little tricky when it's this delicious, but... We have spoken about Symington Family Estates as a family business. Of course, Berry Brothers and Rudd is also a family business. And there's actually quite a close history between the two families, isn't there? I mean, I know we like to work closely with our producers, but we work particularly closely with you guys.
Absolutely. There's lovely strands of the relationship between the two families. And actually, in the world of wine, there aren't that many British-owned family businesses because wine-producing countries, until very recently, didn't include the UK. So multiple generations of my family have walked down St. James's and banged on the door of Berry Brothers to come and show usually vintage ports en primeur. There's an excellent story whereby my grandfather's generation, at the time, we had Grahams, Dows and Wars. And so when you declare a vintage, which typically happens three times a decade, we would go out to all the merchants, including BB&R, and say, these are our young vintage ports. Would you like to make an offer to your customer base? And at the time, my grandfather and his two cousins had decided that they would individually do the marketing and promotion of one would do Grahams, one would do Dows, and one would do Wars. And so En Primeur campaign comes round for vintage port. And my grandfather, Michael, who was representing Dows, comes and bangs on the door of number 3 St. James's and gets let in and meets Christopher Berry Green, who I believe is a famous figure in this company's history. And he shows the Dows ports and the stunning ports. And Christopher's very polite and he'll say, well, we'll undoubtedly place an order. And then about 3 hours later, my great uncle Ian bangs on the door showing Wars port. And Christopher Berry Green was, again, impeccably polite and does the same thing. He heard that James Symington was going to come that afternoon to show Grahams, and he thought, this is just too much. So he put a sign in the windows saying, no hawkers, no Symingtons, which has gone down in both families' histories as this apocryphal tale, which did actually happen. But I think a reflection of the warmth and mutual good regard between the two family businesses.
In fact, that partnership continues today, and you're branching out from Portugal. You have ended up in Hampshire.
Sunny Hampshire. So this is a lovely story because there are two firsts. This is the first time the joint venture between Symington Family Estates and Berry Brothers and Rudd is the first time that BB&R have gone into wine production in 325 years, which is remarkable. And it's the first time that we, although we're very British, have produced wine outside of Portugal. So two firsts. I think a match made in heaven. I met Lizzie Rudd at the Grahams Lodge in May 2022, and we got on like a house on fire, and we clearly saw the world in a similar way. And we were talking about lots of stuff, sustainability, climate change, family business, succession, what to do with the next generation and all of these things. And then halfway through lunch, she said, do you want to buy an English sparkling wine business together? And that was the beginning of a process that very recently has resulted in us acquiring Hambledon Vineyard together, which is extremely exciting. Hambledon has one of the most incredible terroir stories in the south of England, produces an impeccable range of English sparkling wines that regularly are beating champagnes in blind tastings.
Yep.
And over the coming 5 to 10 years, these two family businesses are going to be committed as joint owners in not just taking Hambledon from strength to strength, but also leading the establishment of English sparkling wine as one of the world's great fine wines, which actually anyone who's tasted these wines, I think would agree, isn't presumptuous.
And will it just be sparkling wine? Do you have designs on still wine and fortified wine from England?
Fortified, well, maybe eventually if it gets warm enough here. I mean, for now, Hambledon has really built its reputation around these incredibly delicious sparkling wines made with Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier and Chardonnay.
You mentioned your and Lizzie's shared love of sustainability, and you were recently awarded B Corp status. Is that right?
Yes, we became a B Corporation in 2019, which is a company-wide certification and framework. Well, it's the most comprehensive sustainability certification for a business in the world. So it covers all the pillars from governance to people to community to the environment. It was a big step for us. We're very proud to take that step because in our DNA as a family, often is the case with family wineries, we always had care for the environment and care for people. But in today's world, it's not sufficient just to do a little bit of old school philanthropy and or say you're doing a good job. It's much better and more credible to adhere to an external framework and have someone else, a third party, validate and audit you.
And do you think that that's more relevant to consumers than saying that you're organic or biodynamic? Or do you think it's more all-encompassing? Would you go down the biodynamic route as well in future?
I think sustainability is a bit of a minefield for people who are shopping because there are so many frameworks and there's so many labels and it can be quite confusing. So we owe it to people to not muddy the waters. Organic is something that certainly in the UK is very well understood. And we actually do farm the Douro's largest area of organic vineyard. Actually, it's where that Touriga Nacional nursery was back in the day. We decided to become a B Corp because it's not just limited to the wine sector. And it's not just what you do in the vineyard, because what you do in a vineyard as a wine company, it's only a part of your footprint and your impact. Things are changing rapidly. By 2026, every medium and large business in the EU is going to be obliged to publish a sustainability report. So something that possibly a decade ago was seen as fringe or something that only the real activist companies were getting behind, today is increasingly table stakes. It's a requirement to do business. And actually, lots of the big retailers and importers around the world, and in Europe in particular, are requiring us to prove what we're doing to be as responsible as possible, both environmentally and socially. So with B Corp and the other things that we're doing this year, we became the first winery in Portugal to achieve the new sustainable wine growing certification of Portugal. So we're the first company to do that. And in fact, the Portuguese independent wine body created this framework because we asked for it. We said, please, there are certain markets, particularly in Scandinavia, where unless Portugal has a national sustainability certification for wine growing, we won't get sufficient credits in the tenders in those markets. I see this as a form of staying relevant and competitive in the market. I also see it as a way of future-proofing our business because, frankly, this is about risk management. It's not just about warm and fluffy stuff. It's about going back to that thing of continuously evolving. Yeah. It's making sure that whether it's the trade expectations or the people who drink our wines, that we are demonstrating that we're a responsible, agile, future-thinking company.
Seems very sensible to me. Well, before we let you go, which bottle in your cellar, and I can only imagine that this will be quite a tricky question, wealth of bottles at your disposal, but which bottle in your cellar are you most looking forward to uncorking in the future?
Can I slightly twist the question and give you an answer that I think will be interesting? So you talked about the Graham family motto, which is nobly, never forget. And we have in our cellars in Porto, which by the way is 2 kilometers from the Atlantic. So we really are aging these wines just on the front of the Atlantic weather system. 3 casks from 1882. So these 3 casks were bought by AJ once he'd established himself and had set up his own port shipping operation. And he said, well, one day someone will do something special with these wines. And about 9 years ago, we bottled 1 cask and we released 770 bottles in decanter. And we called it Nubli 1882. And they were the most recent decanters have been selling for about 15,000 euros. But the decision by my father and his cousins was the next generation is going to decide what to do with the next 2 casks, which falls on me. So when do we release this wine, the next cask, and what do we do with it? Unfortunately, retirement age seems to be getting further and further away from us. But I hope by the time I retire, sometime in the 2050s, that my generation and my colleagues have decided what to do with the next cask of 1882. And I'm really looking forward to tasting what that wine tastes like at that point in time.
Wow, that really will be the taste of future thinking, forward planning and family legacy, really. Well, do let us know when you get around to bottling them. I'm sure you'll have many, many willing volunteers to help write the tasting notes for this.
Maybe when you come to the factory house, invitation is now on record. We'll see whether we can find a sample of the 1882 and that will really make the day very memorable.
That sounds fantastic. Rob, thank you so, so much for your time. It's been absolutely fascinating to hear all of your thoughts about port and many other things besides. So thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd. If you'd like to browse any of the ports mentioned in today's podcast, visit bbr.com/podcast. Or if you're interested in starting your own fine wine collection, all the information you need can be found on bbr.com/collecting. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you again for listening. I'm off to track down some really old tawny port. Cheers.